facts, etc., to young men, narrates the history of a young man of high talents and standing, promoted to an important post of honor, which he once filled satisfactorily to his constituents, and who had amassed considerable wealth, and was engaged to be married as follows. But his health began to fail. His constant complaint was, "My nerves are weak, my hands tremble, my wrists ache, my knees are weak, I have bad dreams, etc." He was advised to take outdoor exercise, ride horseback, and take strengthening remedies with a nourishing diet. But all this did no good. The symptoms increased. He soon became dyspeptic and hypochondriac, and then followed not only the aches and pains that were consequent upon such a state of the body, but all those 10,000 imaginary physical and mental diseases that flesh is heir to. Every remedy was used, but to no purpose. He gave up his business, broke off his engagement with his lady, sought every opportunity to hide himself from the gaze of his friends and the world, and seemed to be determined to die. Thus he remained a most wretched devotee to the suicidal practice of self-pollution. Professional advice and that of his friends, who knew the cause of his sickness, had no effect upon him. Sometimes, indeed, he would desist for a few days, but it seemed to be only to gather new strength that he might pursue his ruinous career with greater energy. About 2 years ago, he was attacked with palsy of the whole of one side, and which continues to this day. Nocturnal emissions, priapisms, gleet, or watery discharge from the urethra, and aches and pains, with frightful visions, horrid dreams, and idiotic manners, all now present themselves as the sad result of this disgusting, criminal, and soul-destroying habit. He is now a mere pest to his friends, and though but comparatively few persons are aware of the cause of his wretchedness, it is nevertheless true, and can be attributed to none other than the indulgence in solitary vice. Other cases might be referred to, if I had time, of a less revolting nature. For when the indulgence is only occasional, of course the effects are not so alarming. But even then the effects are bad, for there cannot be a single indulgence in this way without producing injury to a certain extent. Of another it narrates thus. A few years ago, I had under my care and instruction a most promising youth. His talents were of the highest order, and he bade fair to take a prominent stand among the first scholars of our country. He entered college and was considered one of the first scholars of his class. It was soon perceived that his constitution was breaking down. Medicine did him but little good. Soon after he graduated, he became melancholy and finally was deranged, and his friends were under the necessity of conveying him to a hospital. It was not until this event that the cause of his complaint was ascertained. It was evident that he had been in the constant habit of criminally indulging himself in secret. In a few months he partially recovered and visited his friends. He has, however, been sent to the hospital again. He is a most melancholy object, for in his lucid moments he is demented, a mere wreck of that superior genius which he once was. When I meet him in the street, I find that idiotic, lascivious smile, which is common in those cases where the individual has been in the constant habit of beastly indulgence. A young man was under my care from one of the southern cities. He was an object of pity. He had become so accustomed to his vicious indulgence that he has been known, even at the dinner table, to practice it. He was extremely irritable, and would often be taken in a fit, spasms, which would continue for hours. His physician did not understand his case, nor was I sensible at the time that his bad habits had produced his partial insanity. He would often disclose some of his practices to his associates when he was insane, which he would much regret when he had recovered his reason. I have understood that since his return to his friends, he has but partially recovered. He is demented and is unfit for the common avocations of life. Another young man, who was under my care not long since, is obliged to leave his studies, and is just going into a decline, and self-pollution is the cause. I have conversed with him, and he is sensible of his error, but I fear too late. A letter to Mrs. Gove, narrating its writer's experience, describes its effects on the mind as follows. At about 12 years of age, my health began to fail. I became dyspeptic and nervous. I often awoke in the morning, bathed in tears. And the most indescribable and horrible sinking of spirits was my portion during the forenoon. If I committed any little mistake or fault, the recollection of it would haunt me for days and make me superlatively wretched. I became pale as death, weak, feeble, and emaciated. I had severe palpitation of the heart, pain in the side, and many symptoms of consumption. I had also much of the time distressing pain in the head. I had much dizziness, and my sight would often become entirely obscured, especially when I stooped and rose quickly. It renders them, says an English author, stupid, dull, and melancholy, and destroys all their vivacity, cheerfulness, and health. It brings on consumptions, weakness, barrenness, and all that dreadful train of nervous complaints which make them timid, whimsical, and ridiculous. Another patient writes thus, "My enthusiasm is sensibly diminished. My perceptions are very dull. The fire of imagination, much less vivid. Every passing event appears to me like a dream. I have less power of conception and less presence of mind. In a word, I feel as if I am wasting away, although my sleep, appetite, and countenance are good." The empire which this odious practice gains over the senses, says Tissot, is beyond expression. No sooner does this uncleanness get possession of the heart than it pursues its votaries everywhere and governs them at all times and in all places. Upon the most serious occasions and in the solemn acts of religion, they find themselves transported with lustful conceptions and desires which take up all their thoughts. Dr. Woodward gives the following from a letter written by a patient. "Having endured so long under this blighting, withering curse, my constitution, naturally very strong, is broken down, and my mind as well as body completely enervated. I am haunted day and night with lascivious thoughts and dreams, suspicious of my friends, and disgusted with myself. My memory has lost its power, unable to fix my attention. My mind is filled with terrible forebodings, fear of insanity, and at times it has cost me a continual effort to retain my reason. It is with difficulty that I walk, or stand, or even sit erect. An inclination to lie down and sleep, which desire I am sensible I have indulged too much, my sleep never refreshes me. I rise in the morning weak and weary, to drag out another miserable day. Oh, how often have I wished for death, or rather oblivion, or anything to terminate my woes. I have of late been much annoyed with constant little twitchings or spasms in various parts of my body, and frequently my face. Would to God I had known what I now know, when first tempted to this health, life, and soul-destroying vice. I feel that I cannot hold out much longer." Behold in the following autobiography of a patient the mental anguish and derangement this practice engenders. After saying that he commenced the practice at about 14 years of age and had kept it up at intervals for many years, he writes, "During the whole of this time, I have suffered the most intense and unmitigated misery. Although blessed by nature with an excellent constitution and with a kindly, cheerful disposition, I have become dyspeptic, gloomy, and unsociable. I am wretchedly timid and irresolute, my mind very weak and filled with imaginary terrors. In fine, I have suffered so much in body and mind, and seeing no prospect of being restored to health and usefulness, that I am sunk in despair and am daily contemplating suicide. It is the anguish my death would cause my mother and sister, whom I devotedly love, and for whom I would wish to live, and whom I would wish to maintain, that mainly prevents. But why detail more? These are the constitutional effects of this sin. Behold, the mind a wreck, the soul undone. It engenders depravity in all its forms. But all this, most terrible as it is not the worst. Amativeness, being situated in the midst of the animal organs, and this indulgence tending necessarily to inflame it, its inflammation, of course, inflames, diseases, and perverts them also. Section 3 of Love shows that the morbid, painful, diseased action of the propensities constitutes depravity. And this section shows that this excess diseases both the cerebellum and the body, with both of which the animal propensities are so intimately related that whatever deranges the former thereby perverts the latter, and this causes depravity. Or thus, excessive indulgence inflames the sexual organs, the whole body, and amativeness located in the cerebellum, in particular, and this inflames and depraves the whole animal group of organs, and thereby creates sin in all its forms. Corresponding with, and explained by this, is the fact that lust, the world over, is the concomitant and parent of all other sins. In what portions of our cities, towns, and villages is perpetrated the most wickedness? Wherever are congregated the votaries of Venus? Where will groggeries be found the most abundant, the most frequented? In the streets and lanes of wantonness, where are you most liable to be robbed? There also, and by whom? Its inhabitants. What but prostitution could make woman, a amiable woman, swear and lie and cheat and drink and carouse and rob and even murder? In what part of Boston was that recent tragical murder of Mrs. Bickford committed? In Old Town, the Five Points of that goodly city. By whom? A libertine. On whom? A lewd woman. In short, the dens of prostitution are everywhere the dens of crime in all its forms, in all its aggravation. And what is true of these masses is true of those individuals who compose them. Who are our defaulters, our swindlers, our gamblers, etc.? Frequenters of lewd houses, always. No equal incentive to dishonesty and criminality exists. Fortunes are yearly stolen by clerks, agents, etc., and covered by false entries, simply to obtain the means of gratifying this passion. How much the judgment alone can reveal. Though intemperance will soon run a man down, and wring his last cent from him, to feed those fatal fires which are consuming soul and body, yet it is a pygmy compared with this giant robber. It will drain the last cent, and then pursue its victim night and day, till he becomes literally desperate, and is almost compelled to lie, steal, forge, rob, any and everything to procure the wages of this sin. Do as great a business as he may, he rarely becomes rich, but see how many fortunes it has squandered. No one who goes after strange women can be good, honest, and true, but he who does will commit almost any other form of sin. This passion will sow the seeds of depravity in the purest souls and convert those most irreproachable into demons. This is staple truth. Apply it where you will. Moralists, behold in this relation of perverted sexuality to universal depravity your first work of reform. As long as this passion is thus uncontrolled and perverted, so long will all other forms of depravity be rife, and all forms of virtue be trampled in the dust. Ministers may preach till doomsday against any and all other vices without effect, till they preach moral purity, and in all its forms. It is a matter of perfect surprise that so few ministers preach against this sin in any of its forms, especially against self-abuse. But most of them, though posted on the moral watchtowers of society, are dead dogs that will not bark, touching this, the very keystone of the arch of depravity. Is it not high time that some moral champion should stand forth to proclaim this vital truth? Lawyers will not do it, nor doctors, except a few noble Woodwards, nor ministers. Shall then this monster be left undisturbed to feed on the physical and mental caresses of his prey? God forbid, if the ministerial profession will so far prove recreant to their high moral trust, and the other professions follow their example of silence, help must come from some other quarter. For this age of reform must begin reformation here. And the author is free to confess that an overwhelming desire to prevent iniquity in its other forms as well as this, and by sanctifying and properly directing this propensity to promote general moral excellence and obviate general corruption, mainly dedicated these pages. He wishes to aid in rendering after generations better by nature, more intellectual, more pure and holy in soul, and elevated in aspiration by this work, to stay licentiousness, public and private, by showing the superiority of moral purity over sinful propensity, in order thereby to promote moral purity and all other virtues on the one hand, and on the other, to prevent this vice and thereby all other forms of human depravity and woe. It perpetuates and reaugments itself. We have seen that excess begets inflammation, and that inflammation creates desire. Hence, every new indulgence only reaugments the cravings of this propensity. As an inflammation of the stomach causes a morbid hankering after food, the gratification of which still further increases both the disease and the craving, so excessive sexual indulgence fevers these organs, so that they call still more loudly for gratification. Every new indulgence of which reaugments the inflammation, and consequently the power of passion, till like the letting out of waters, it rises and rushes, till life itself is emptied out thereat, and both body and mind swept on to remediless destruction and woe. Indulgence is fuel to these already consuming fires of perdition. This propensity being to the sexual apparatus precisely what appetite is to the stomach, since as eating, so far from satisfying the ravenous cravings of the dyspeptic, only increases them by re-inflaming the stomach. So sensual indulgence first inflames the sexual apparatus, and this re-increases both disease and desire, till the entire system is drained of energy, and its victim dies. This passion inflamed by indulgence becomes the horse-leech of life and happiness, crying perpetually, louder and louder, "Give, give, give," but never enough, or the gluttonous tapeworm, the more it is fed, the more insatiate its ravages, till after having devoured all the other powers and faculties of its miserable victim, it ends only in a death of all deaths the most horrible. Like the falling, perhaps, of an icicle on Mount Blaine, which gathers size and force as it descends, and now rolls heavily and rapidly down the steep sides of yonder towering cliff, anon bounds from peak to peak, sweeping their snowy sides and tearing up huge trees and rocks in its resistless course, till leaping yonder yawning precipice, it plunges into the deep abyss, dashing to atoms both itself and all its prey, scattering ruin and death in all its course. Nor does this principle govern one form of sensual indulgence merely, but all its forms. It is inherent in all forms, and appertains alike to matrimonial, promiscuous, and personal indulgence in all their stages. Animals, one and all, before their first indulgence, experience only a moderate power of this impulse, but afterwards become uncontrollable. The less it is exercised, the more easily can it be held in check. Beware then, O youth, how you unchain this roaring lion, till walled in by wedlock, else propensity will haunt and goad you night and day, clamorous for indulgence, yet never satisfied till your ruin is complete. Indulge but once, and you will have no peace of your life, but will be dashed hither and yon, with those waves of passion, into which one false step plunges you. If you have no regard for the sin committed, yet regard your own subsequent peace and happiness of life. Mark, we do not put this matter on its moral turpitude, but on its necessarily consequent evils and sufferings. First, because the latter involves the former, and is the cause or rationale of all sin. The reason why sin is sinful, as well as the measure of the sinfulness of sin, and because we thus appeal to the two strongest and even the governing motives of human nature, namely, first, to its love of happiness, and secondly, to its dread of suffering. Not that it is not most sinful, it is morally wrong in exact proportion to its miseries, which we have just seen to be so frightful. The effects of promiscuous indulgence, matrimonial excess, and self-abuse compared. Thus far, our inquiries have related to the constitutional effects of excessive sexual indulgence in its collective capacity, or indiscriminately in all its forms. But this hydra monster assumes many forms, three of which deserve consideration. Licentiousness. The promiscuous indulgence is most sinful, is evident from that terrible penalty affixed to its perpetration. To be eaten up by piecemeal, with sores and ulcers, nauseating and loathsome beyond description, to lose bone and muscle and nerve by inches, and literally be eaten up alive, besides being simultaneously tortured with agony, the most excruciating mortals can endure, affixes nature's seal of proportional moral turpitude upon its cause. Consequences thus direful show that their cause must be a sin proportionally aggravated. Quacks may essay to cure it, but its virulent poison still lurks in the veins for life. Calomel may give immediate relief, but the grave alone can entirely eradicate it. Sin ye who will, but suffer ye who sin. God is just, and but visits his violated law with meet retribution.